Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. S.J. Olshansky. He's a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's a research associate at the Center for Aging at the University of Chicago and also involved with similar things at the London School of Hygiene and Public Health. His research to date has been on estimates of the upper limits of human longevity, exploring the health and public policy implications associated with both individual and population aging, forecasts of size, survival, and age structure of the population, and the pursuit of the scientific means to slowing aging in people. A link on his on our website to a book he was involved in writing called The Quest for Immortality, Science at the Frontiers of Aging. Dr. Olshansky, it's a pleasure to welcome you back to Line One.
Pleasure to be back once again.
All right. I like to start with definitions. It seems that's a little bit of science still creeps into my old age. What is aging? Let's define that.
Oh, goodness. You could talk to a dozen scientists and get a dozen different answers, but probably the best one that you'll hear is the random accumulation of damage to the building blocks of life. The building blocks being carbohydrates and proteins and fats, and the damage accumulates throughout the course of life and eventually impairs the functioning of cells, tissues, and organs, and ultimately gives rise to many of the diseases that we see as we grow older.
I want to make one brief change here. I was going to keep going on this. I think this is important, but I realize I forgot to give our phone number, so I want to remind listeners if you've got questions about longevity and aging today, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. So aging seems to be all about this DNA replication and errors that occur along the way and then everything downstream from reading and transcription of that DNA. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's part of it. I mean, there are so many elements to the aging process that it's difficult to find something that influences them all, at least for the moment. And so it's not just damage to DNA, it's damage to other components of the body, and then there's just basic wear and tear. And then we have the loss of certain parts of the body with the passage of time, certain hormones and muscle fibers and neurons. Those are largely non-replicating cells. And so, the moment the engine of life switches on, the human body begins producing the very same toxic substances that ultimately lead to its own demise. So there's a lot of processes going on simultaneously. It's not just one. And the fact that it's so complicated is why it's so difficult to address.
Mm-hmm. In one of the podcasts I was listening to, some of the markers of aging in humans, at least this researcher was discussing, was a decrease in brain size, a lack of new neurons, decrease in stem cells. Are those kinds of things, or are there specific markers that seem to have a better indicator, not just in animal studies, but in humans, that aging is going on?
Well, this issue of biomarkers, of trying to find some measure, something that we could track with the passage of time that would enable us to measure our true biological age, that effort has been ongoing for decades, believe it or not, and the National Institute on Aging spent an enormous amount of money trying to find biomarkers of aging, and it largely failed. So right now, there aren't really any good generic, general, validated biomarkers that tell us how old we are biologically, in spite of the fact, by the way, that there's lots of people, entrepreneurs, willing to sell you kits or even tests that you could take that would somehow tell you your biological age. We actually can't do that.
Okay.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah. I want to stay with this genetics and the DNA a little bit, and it looks like somebody else who's listening's got the same idea. So I'm going to take a call from James. James, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Good afternoon. I was wondering if you could have your guest speak to the function of telomeres and the work that's being done to extend or rejuvenate the telomeres. And I'll take my answer offline.
Okie doke. So what's a telomere? Let's start there, and then what does it have to do with aging?
Well, think about telomere as the end cap of your DNA, very much like on your shoelaces, the end cap of your shoelaces. And every time a cell replicates, a little piece of the end of that telomere is lopped off. And when enough of it's lopped off, the cell goes through a process called apoptosis or programmed cell death, which actually is a good thing. You really want those non-functioning cells to die off. And so what some researchers have discovered is that if you introduce an enzyme called telomerase, it stops the loss of the telomeres and it enables cells to live longer. And of course, that is a characteristic of cancer cells, by the way, and therein lies part of the danger. So some researchers have speculated that if we could find a way to introduce telomerase, we could get cells to live longer and whole organisms to live longer. And there was some research just published recently from scientists at Harvard suggesting that they could actually make cells grow younger, that they could actually reverse biological aging in some cells. Now, the researchers themselves said, hey, be careful here. We're not suggesting we're going to reverse biological aging in whole organisms. We can do it in cells. It's telling us something about the puzzle of aging. It's not the whole puzzle, but it's an interesting one. And there was a Nobel Prize given out just a couple of years ago for the researchers who discovered this whole process.
So the telomeres seem to be an important aspect of cellular aging, and it may not be true that that's true of a group of cells or an organism's aging, is what I'm hearing you say. Plus there must be other risks to this.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, we have nuclear DNA, the DNA that's contained within the center of the cell that's essentially the blueprints of life. And then we have mitochondrial DNA, a source of DNA from the energy factories contained within the cell. And it's, there's research suggesting that the damage to the mitochondrial DNA might be equally important as the damage to the nuclear DNA. So it's not entirely clear that if we introduce telomerase that we're stopping the damage to all DNA within the cells. And so, I'd be a little bit cautious about being overly optimistic about this type of research, but it does reveal some elements of aspects of aging that scientists previously hadn't been able to address very well. And it's leading many researchers, myself among them, to be optimistic that someday we may be able to find an intervention that slows aging in people.
Let me ask a reminder. Listeners, that is, again, if you've got questions or comments about aging and longevity, particularly in humans, this is a good place to call and ask your questions. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@ksk.org, and we'll be here for another 50 minutes or so if you've got questions or comments. What about genes? We get hints of aging, information about aging from certain diseases where we know genes are not working effectively or are absent, and they promote or appear to promote generalized increased aging. Are there hints there that we should discuss or talk about?
Well, let's deal with the issue of genes and longevity first, because this comes up all the time, and the question everyone asks is, how long am I going to live, and what's the importance of genes versus environment? Now, if you ask many researchers in the field, what you will get is an answer that sounds something like it's roughly 50% genes and 50% environment. Now, I'm actually, to be honest with you, not even sure what that means. If you possess a gene that is lethal, like Tay-Sachs, a gene for Tay-Sachs disease, it's 100% certain that you are going to die from Tay-Sachs disease very early in life. There's a number of other genetically related diseases and disorders as well that are inherited. And so in a way, longevity is 100% genetics and 100% environment. Even if you have the genes for long life, which we believe exists, by the way. There are subgroups of the population that live past 100 and even 110, and clearly many of the risk factors for the rest of us are not risk factors for them. You know, the first prescription for a long life is to choose long-lived parents. Once you've done that, about the only control you have over your duration of life is to shorten it through behavioral risk factors. So you control, you know, smoking and drinking and exercise, and you've pretty much done the most that you can do to influence your health and quality of life, and the rest is up to genetics and random damage that occurs with the passage of time. I don't know if that's good news or bad news. You know, at one level, it's good news because it tells us that there isn't an aging program that's built into our genes, and it means that we don't have to intervene in some sort of, you know, master program that exists. That's the good news. The bad news is that it's so complicated that it's going to be difficult to find a single intervention that influences all genetic and non-genetic aspects of aging simultaneously.
So there's not, or at least at this point, there doesn't appear to be specific genes that we can identify that are associated with a longer lifespan or a shorter lifespan per se?
Well, actually, some researchers, for example, Nir Barzilai in New York and Tom Perls in Boston, have identified genes that centenarians, people who live past 100, tend to have. And so they have been identifying genes that are associated with longevity. And I use that word carefully because associated with and the cause of longevity are two different things. We can't have genes that either kill us early or which were designed to make us live long, because evolution could not have given rise to genes that operate for specific purposes in older regions of the lifespan where very few humans throughout history ever lived. So death genes and aging genes can't exist. But clearly, genes exist that protect us from the diseases and disorders that are associated with aging, and it may even be possible that some of us possess genes that enable us to age more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not there for that purpose. They're there for another purpose, but one of the byproducts of this is decelerated aging or lower disease risk, and identifying what those are and how we can confer those advantages to other people, that's what scientists are now seeking.
I'm going to guess, or to use an example of what you're discussing, is the BRCA gene, that the lack of function of the products of that gene increases the risk of breast and ovarian cancer in women. And that, as I understand it, that gene's products helps repair damage to DNA. And when you don't have that, you get more DNA damage and therefore a greater risk for cancer. So you're saying maybe there are genes that some of us have that do some of this cleanup or fix mistakes in the cell that allow us to live longer. Is that, in a sense, what you're saying?
Yes. Basically, the human body is exposed to so many toxins in a single day. I think it's been estimated that every cell is exposed to roughly 10,000 potentially damaging hits every day, every cell in the body. So we have an incredibly intricate and efficient mechanism for identifying and repairing damage to DNA. It's so incredibly efficient, it's nearly 99.999% efficient. But it's that small amount of inefficiency that accumulates with the passage of time. So the body has evolved incredibly efficient mechanisms for mopping up the damage or preventing the damage to DNA. And some of us are clearly better at it than others, and identifying exactly how that happens, how that operates, is what researchers are now seeking.
Are some of those hits, ionizing radiation, toxic chemicals, also implicated in aging independent of the fact that they may increase the risk of disease?
Yes. I mean, you know, researchers identified long ago these substances known as free radicals that are produced when cells are breaking up. And you've heard a lot about these. You'll see them in advertisements all the time about free radicals. And there are entrepreneurs taking advantage of this, by the way. But yes, there are there is damage to nuclear DNA and mitochondrial DNA associated with these free radicals. The body produces its own free radical scavengers. We can eat free radical scavengers in the form of more fruits and vegetables. Taking pills, you know, vitamins, nutritional supplements that contain vitamin C and E and others are thought by some to influence free radicals, but the evidence isn't there. The strong evidence is there for eating more fruits and vegetables and its ability to reduce the risk of damage and reduce the risk of disease.
In my introduction, I mentioned that you've been involved in thinking about and perhaps directly researching theoretical limits for human longevity. That's an area we kind of haven't addressed yet. You want to comment and help us understand that issue?
Well, think of it this way. Back in 1900, life expectancy in the United States was about 50 for women and about 46 for men. So the average was about 48. The reason why it was so low was because there was high infant and child mortality and high maternal mortality during childbirth. Now, what happened during the course of the 20th century is we dramatically reduced early age mortality. So we eliminated many of those infectious diseases, and now people have the opportunity to live to older ages with regularity for the first time in history. So we added about 30 years to life expectancy, principally by saving the young. In the latter part of the 20th century, we successfully reduced the risk of heart disease, stroke, and some forms of cancer. But the gains in life expectancy were much, much smaller as we were attempting to influence diseases that are expressed later in life. And the reason why the gains were smaller was because we're butting up against basic biological processes of aging, that even if we eliminate disease, we still face biological aging itself. So we now have life expectancies of about 80 for women, a little bit less for men. In some parts of the world, in Japan, for example, it's up to 86 for women. But we can't really push those numbers that much higher. We're not talking about getting up to 100 or 120 anytime soon. We might be able to add 5 to 10 years to that with extraordinary effort, but we're pretty much pushing the envelope right now.
So I think that's an important issue. We are definitely living longer, but we need to understand one of the reasons for that is that we got rid of a lot of the reasons that we died young. So we really never had an opportunity as humans to see what the life expectancy is. And now with the advances of health care, and I'm going to be careful about this because I want to ask about the difference between health and health care a little bit perhaps later, but even better public health, sanitation, better incomes, people eating better and so forth, we've controlled those things that killed us earlier in life, including tuberculosis, which may be somehow related to not necessarily how we're treating it, but how standard of living improved. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, the majority of those early increases in life expectancy were a result of advances in public health. Mm-hmm. So we've grown, we've become very good at insulating ourselves from the outside world, from the normal infectious diseases that tended to kill most humans throughout history. And so that insulation enabled aging to be expressed in our species really for the first time at a level like we've never seen before. Mm-hmm. Now, you do see it in other species, by the way, and it should be obvious. You see it in your pets, and you see it in zoo animals and laboratory animals. And what do all of those species have in common? Well, they're all raised in controlled living environments with access to certain types of food supplies, and predation is pretty much eliminated for those organisms. And under those conditions, you get to see aging in all of these animals for the first time. And the kinds of things that go wrong with us, for the most part, are very much the same kinds of things that you see go wrong in your dog and cat, and that we see go wrong in horses and other animals. It's quite remarkable, actually.
What are the rate-limiting illnesses, problems that we're coming up against then if we are resolving the acute infectious disease and, I'm hesitant to say nutritional issues, but at least the infectious causes of problems. What's stopping us now that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, so that's the right question. So what are the rate-limiting forces that we're facing? Well, all right, think of it this way. The rise of Alzheimer's disease, the rise of prostate cancer, the rise of breast cancer, all expressed at later ages, these diseases and disorders are not a consequence of failure. They're a consequence of success, of individuals living long enough to have these diseases expressed in later regions of the lifespan. Even if we could hypothetically eliminate cancer, if we found a cure for cancer, we would only add about 3 to 3.5 years to life expectancy. That might surprise some. A cure for heart disease wouldn't add much more. A cure for heart disease, cancer, stroke, and diabetes, which is what kills roughly 3 of every 4 people in the developed world, would only add about 10 to 15 years to life expectancy, which means the basic biological processes of aging represent the most important rate-limiting factor that we face. Now, we do have Achilles heels. It should be obvious, just like in your automobile, you have essentially the Achilles heels of your brakes, which fail after roughly 30,000 miles. In humans, we begin losing bone density in our 30s. We begin losing muscle mass relatively early, and we begin losing our neurons relatively early in life. And that accumulated loss leads to what all of us recognize as basic aging itself. And that's something, at least for the moment, we can't influence. So we have to be real careful here. You know, you raised the issue of health earlier. If we push out the envelope of human survival into outer regions of the lifespan where people normally wouldn't survive, you get to see things go wrong with the human body that you ordinarily wouldn't have an opportunity to see. And we may not necessarily like what we see if we make ourselves live longer without ensuring that we are healthier along the way, and that includes a healthy mind and body simultaneously.
Let me remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is S.J. Holshansky. He's an expert on aging and longevity and has done some direct research himself on that. If you've got questions or comments, our local phone number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. And we'll be here till just before 3 o'clock local time. So you're implying that, you know, it's natural for us to assume that living longer is good and that longevity is great, but maybe that's not true.
Well, when it happens the right way, when people make it out healthy and vibrant in both body and mind to older ages, then aging is a wondrous thing. I have a hard time convincing my 20-year-old students of that, by the way, who think of anyone over the age of 20 as, you know, decrepit and old. And, you know, they associate aging with decline and decay. And the question I ask them is, you know, is there anything good associated with growing older? And they actually can't think of anything, ironically enough. These are 20-year-old kids. So, one of the people that I worked with for many years, his name was Bob Butler, Robert Butler. He was the founding director of the National Institute on Aging. And unfortunately, he passed away from an acute illness last July at the age of 83 or 84. And here's an individual who was incredibly active and vibrant right up until about 4 days before his death. And he was smarter at the age of 84 than he was at the age of 54. So when people make it to these older ages with their mind and body intact, it's a wondrous and wonderful thing to see and experience. When you get a mismatch, when the body makes it out to that age and the mind doesn't, it's a disaster. When the mind makes it out and the body doesn't, it's a disaster. And therein lies the dilemma. We can't ensure that everyone is going to make it out to older ages with mind and body intact. And remember, we're doing everything we can now with modern medicine to attack each disease as it arises without influencing the biological processes of aging itself. And so the dilemma is that we may make people live longer, but we may extend the period of frailty and disability for some as a result. That, you know, the price we may have to pay for extended life, for example, as a result of a reduction in the risk of heart disease and cancer, is an increase in the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. Mm-hmm. We may not like what we see.
Mm-hmm. Is it your, just speaking of Alzheimer's, which is another somewhat of an enigma to me and I suspect to others, is it your belief that that is an inevitable consequence of aging rather than a, let's just use the broad term, an environmental impact illness?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, if you look at in the brains of some people with Alzheimer's disease, some parts of their brain have no signs of Alzheimer's disease at all. It's not like it occurs universally throughout the brain. And it doesn't happen in everyone in exactly the same way. And there's people who make it out with no general signs of Alzheimer's disease at all. So it's not universal. It's frequent. It's common. I believe you see it in more than 50% of the population over the age of 85. But I don't think it is a universal phenomenon.
Okay. We are generating some phone calls, and what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to take our typical halfway mid-break right now, and then we'll come back and take some phone calls, and I've also got an email. Remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@kska.org. After this very short break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails and talk with Dr. S.J. Olshansky. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're talking today with University of Illinois at Chicago aging and longevity researcher, Dr. S.J. Olshansky. You can email any questions or comments about aging and longevity to us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org, or you can give us a call at 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And the usual reminder, if you're listening tonight at kska.org, or KSKA on the radio, and you're between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded rebroadcast, and we won't be available for phone calls. Louise, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I wanted to have you guys address the ethical, environmental aspects of the subject of aging. Should we really be attempting to extend people's lives when it will just contribute to the overpopulation of the planet?
Well, all right, this question, thank you for that question. It comes up all the time. And let me ask this, I don't know if the caller is still there, but
yes,
think about it this way. Okay, good. Think about it this way. You should actually be asking the same question about our effort to combat heart disease, cancer, and stroke. So if you've got a heart problem now, or if you get breast cancer, for example, the first thing you're going to do is go to an oncologist and try to extend your life by combating that cancer. So in a way, you're asking the same question of yourself, is it reasonable for me to combat that cancer in order to extend my life? And I think the same logic and rationale applies to aging that applies to all of these individual diseases that we're combating simultaneously. And my answer is the same. If you're going to go after those specific diseases, then for the same reasons, we should be going after aging itself.
Okay. Well, that's a different way to think of it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I've recently read or took a little course about the history of civilization. What's very, very clear is that it seems to me is that science has been able to address this aging or this growing population increasingly and very luckily by being able to increase the amount of food, and we've got more available now than we ever have. So now we're having this problem with the opposite effect for a lot of us in the West. So, but it's always that possibility. We're going to come up against that wall that we no longer have the water, the land, the resources, the science to keep this exponentially growing world population under fed, so to speak.
Though, a lot of population growth that has occurred recently, and certainly a good portion of the population growth that's going to occur between now and 2050, is a result of momentum that is already built into the age structure, the differences between birth rates and death rates that have existed for decades now. So there isn't really anything we can do, quite frankly. No matter what we do, no matter how hard we try, we're not going to be able to stop a population of 9 to 10 billion by mid-century. That is inevitable. So I guess what the caller is asking in a way is, if we succeed in going after aging or many of these diseases, well, it could go to 9.5 or 10 billion. And I understand the logic there, clearly. I think, one of the best ways to address this particular issue of population growth is by reducing fertility rates, birth rates. And that's actually been happening, really, in most parts of the world already. In fact, as you said, in some parts of the world, like in Italy or Spain, for example, the birth rate is so low that they're worried about negative population growth in those countries. Now, of course, it means overpopulation is going to be occurring in China, India, Indonesia, and some other countries. It's not equal across the globe, but it's a legitimate question, but I think the answer is really straightforward. If we're going to go after diseases, we should be going after aging itself.
Okay. Eric, we're on line one with you. What can we do for you?
Just had a question from 10,000 feet. With modern medicine and public health improving our lifespan, are we in fact de-evolving as a species because we're not allowing natural selection to occur?
So we all have glasses now, so is there some kind of a change in the natural selection that technology has allowed us? Is that kind of what you're asking?
Sure. I mean, okay. just as every species evolves through the process of natural selection, right, are we in fact countering it over long term?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And in a way, what you're asking is, now that we're relaxing the selection pressures, I mean, the selection pressures on humans were always high, but the vast majority of those selection pressures prevented people from making it out to older ages. So what we've done, of course, and you can ask the same question, by the way, about the early 20th century, about saving infants and children from dying, because we relaxed those selection pressures and we allowed people to live to older ages with regularity. So is humanity better off or worse off as a result? And this is a very tough, judgmental type of question. And my answer is always the same, and that is I don't really judge populations based on the changes in genetic heterogeneity or diversity that results. So in this case, I would suggest that just because we're relaxing selection pressures and enabling people with lethal diseases and disorders to live longer, I wouldn't say that we're harming humanity in any way possible. We may be changing gene frequencies, but remember, some of those individuals who are surviving are perhaps, the next Mozart or the next great scientist or astronaut or, somebody who's going to invent a cure for aging. Mm-hmm. So I'm very cautious about this particular issue. It's a bit of a touchy one. Diabetes is sort of the classic example. Early onset diabetics would die before they would reproduce. Now, people with early onset diabetes are living into their reproductive years, passing their genes on with greater frequency to future generations. And so the genes associated with early onset diabetes are increasing in the population. Does that mean we're de-evolving or weaker in any way? No. All we are doing is increasing the genetic diversity of the population And, you know, you could ask the question, by the way, if what if it was my son or my daughter that had that genetic disorder? You know, would we be better off with or without them? The answer is obvious.
Thank you.
Yeah, so Stephen Hawking would be an example of, he's got ALS, and yet he's a very important person in the understanding of cosmology today.
Yeah, it is a good example, and I'm much more interested in celebrating our diversity than our lack of it. And so I actually much prefer that great diversity.
Okay. Leonard, you're on line one.
Yes, you've touched on dietary concerns about eating more fruit. Can you expand on that?
Well, there is an incredible amount of scientific evidence demonstrating that the increased ingestion of fruits and vegetables can reduce our risk of a wide variety of diseases and disorders. It's not going to make us live forever, but it can reduce our risk of a wide variety of diseases. And I would add to that, by the way, exercise as one of the other major variables that we, something that we can influence, that can influence our health and quality of life. The same evidence does not exist for nutritional supplements like vitamin C pills or vitamin E pills or others that are designed to essentially contain the essence of the fruits and the vegetables. That evidence is lacking. But the fruits and vegetables themselves, the scientific evidence is crystal clear.
What about low caloric? We certainly, people must be wondering what you have to say about the association between maybe weight loss, but certainly low caloric intake. Is it the fact that fruits and vegetables are helpful in some of these diseases by causing or leading to or helping with weight loss rather than some direct beneficial nutritional value?
Well, that's possible. Certainly the scientific evidence that has been around for decades suggests that reducing caloric intake, otherwise known as caloric restriction or CR, extends life in a wide variety of animals. It probably extends life in humans. But I would be cautious about interpretation here. Certainly in the initial studies on caloric restriction, the animals that were used for comparison were fed what was called ad libitum, which means they were allowed to eat as much as they want, pretty much like us. And when you compare animals that are fed ad libitum, they become obese. They're couch potatoes. And so just about any population relative to couch potatoes is going to have a lower risk of death and a higher longevity. Nevertheless, would we all be better off if we ate less and exercised more? Absolutely. The opposite is happening, as you know, throughout most nations of the developed and even developing world, and that is we're eating more, we're exercising less, we're growing obese, we're acquiring diabetes at much earlier ages. And so we're really doing a lot to combat our own longevity potential. And so there's plenty that we can do to increase our health and quality of life. But whether it's, you know, whether these fruits and vegetables are influencing, you know, our overall caloric intake, or whether there's something in the fruits and vegetables, like free radical scavengers, I think that has yet to be fully established.
Let me just remind our listeners again, this is Line 1, Your Health Connection. We're talking about aging and longevity with Dr. S.J. Olshansky. If you've got questions or comments, you can email us at line1@ksKA.org. Our telephone number locally is 550-8433, 550-8433, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. You know, for me, you got to be careful a lot about these confounding variables. You know, for a long time, cigarette smoking seemed to be everybody did it, so it was involved and associated with everything. And now I keep thinking in my own mind that exercise and weight are critically important. And is it true that maybe people who exercise a lot, even if they're overweight, may benefit from that exercise, and it's really the exercise that's the important issue and not the weight? I think there's been a little bit of some evidence suggesting that those that are overweight, if they keep exercising, it's beneficial. But it can be difficult to tease out those two kinds of things, especially in well-done research, I think.
Yes, it's complicated. I mean, remember, you're not going to see any obese extreme elderly people, or you'll see very few of them. Okay. And the reason is because those that are obese tend to die earlier mm-hmm. from obesity-related diseases and disorders. It's the same thing with smoking. But you do see some people who make it out to very old ages who smoked. I mean, the longest-lived person in the world, Jeanne Calmon from France, lived for 122 years, and she smoked for 100. So clearly smoking was not a risk factor for her, and that's not, of course, that's not a reason for the rest of us to pick up smoking. Yeah, it's pretty shocking, isn't it? And actually, if you look at the lifestyles of many of these long-lived individuals, it's atrocious. Uh-huh. You know, they drink drink a lot, which, by the way, is precisely why I'm so interested in the studies of these individuals, because uh-huh. many of these individuals are treating their bodies very poorly, uh-huh. and yet they're surviving to old age. So there's something protecting them, and I want to figure out what it is.
Well, as you said before, and the next logical question is, how well did they select their genes? How long did their mothers and fathers live? And then that's a difficult one also, because maybe they died of trauma, but maybe they died of infections that were killing everybody else at that point, and this person was just lucky, you know?
Yeah, well, when we do the research right, we do try and eliminate the traumatic causes of death. Uh-huh. And you're right. If you look back at the longevity of these long-lived people, the vast majority of them have very long-lived siblings. They have long-lived parents mm-hmm. and grandparents. Jeanne Calmon, they went back and studied her family history going back about 10 generations in France. And I think the average life expectancy of her ancestors was somewhere in the mid-70s, during a time in which life expectancy in France was in the 30s. So there's a very strong genetic component that influences duration of life, but, you know, it's easy to overcome that strong genetic component by stepping in front of a bus mm-hmm. Or, you know, becoming obese. So there are, or smoking cigarettes. So there are things that we can do to overcome that longevity potential that may exist within many of us, and that's what public health is all about, trying to get us to try to stop mm-hmm. shortening our lifespan by, you know, adopting unhealthy lifestyles.
Which I guess raises another question in my mind. I would think that the evidence is pretty good that health care may have had some impact on increasing the longevity, that is, by enabling us to treat pneumonia and tuberculosis. But there is an overall increase in health related to just the increase in our lifestyle, our income, you know, just the whole growth of civilization as well.
Yes.
And now I forgot what my train where I was
well,
going with this, but
right, I know where you're going with this. So think of it this way. What's happened during the course of the 20th century is we have grown, we have much more successfully educated our population. If you look at each successive generation during the course of the 20th century, we were more highly educated. And if you look at the health and the longevity of populations by nothing more than education alone, you will see dramatic changes in health and quality and duration of life for the more highly educated. And we refer to these as gradients mm-hmm. in longevity as a function of education. Now, education, income, they all relate to one another. You know, these are socioeconomic factors that influence longevity, and that's, I think, the essence of your question. As we've become more affluent as a society, as a species, how has that influenced our longevity? And I think it's actually been tremendous. But remember, once we saturate the population with more highly educated individuals, we've used up that resource. And so, you know, under those conditions, you then focus on subgroups of the population that are less highly educated as a way to bring them up to the same longevity that you see in other populations. And that's not going to be easy to do. So it's, you know, education, income, socioeconomic factors are all and have always been extremely important. And I'll point out, by the way, that my colleagues and I published a paper about 5 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine suggesting that some subgroups of the population may be on the verge of a decline in life expectancy for the first time in the modern era as a result of dramatic increases in adult onset and childhood onset obesity. And the first subgroups are going to be minorities, principally blacks and Hispanics in the U.S. And it's not, you know, it is not fair to see these types of disparities. And the disparities are dramatic, by the way. The longest lived, what's the best way to say this? If you compare the most highly educated white population, people with 16 plus years of education, with the least educated black subgroup of the population, with less than 12 years of education, the difference in life expectancy is about 16 years. The difference is also dramatic within races, within blacks and within whites, but those changes that you see are absolutely dramatic. 16 years is a quantum difference in subgroups of the population, so it's pretty shocking to see what the effect of socioeconomic status is on health and longevity.
The CDC has just recently published, I think the first time they've really looked at health inequality issues, and we've talked about this on this program, I think three times was Steve Baruchka of the University of Washington School of Public Health about that. And it raises another little question that I have on my list that kind of looks at this a little differently as well, and that is, what are the probable reasons that the life expectancy in Americans has decreased relative to most of the developed world over the last 25 years? Everybody knows we're living longer, but a lot of people don't realize we're living longer slower than a lot of the Western world, and that raises this question about health equality to some degree.
Yes, that's a good question, although I would point out that in many of these countries, while they were experiencing more accelerated increases than us, so we weren't really experiencing declines, we were just experiencing less accelerated increases, which I think is the point that you're making. And it does look like we're falling behind, and in fact we are. And it may have to do with subgroups of the U.S. population that are doing much more poorly relative to the rest of the population. I think Hispanics are currently 15% of the population, blacks I think 25%, or something like that, 20-25%. And so, and they have much higher, certainly infant mortality, and infectious disease mortality and accidental mortality earlier in life, which lowers the overall life expectancy of the population. And in other places like Japan and France, for example, you're seeing a continuation of a long period of increasing or rising life expectancy. And so the differences between the countries are increasing. Now, how much longer that can go on, I don't know. There's some reason to believe that these rapid, large increases in life expectancy in Japan are going to come to an end. And there's a number of reasons for that, the most important of which is that we're now seeing rather dramatic increases in obesity among the Japanese, including adults and children. And it's also possible that the very low mortality that we see among older Japanese today could be a result of something that you mentioned earlier, caloric restriction. It's possible that these individuals, when they came out of World War II, were calorically restricted for a number of years during a very important phase in their life, and that may have led to increased longevity among this cohort today. So once that cohort passes through, we may see a drop in life expectancy and increase in death rate. So it's very complicated by what we see among the dynamics existing in subgroups of the population.
We're in our last 10 minutes. If anybody's got some questions that are eating at them out there and you want to ask them, this is the time to call. 550-8433 is our local number, line1@kska.org if you want to email. There's an email asking if we should all be taking a little bit of wine at night. That's not exactly what they say, but that's the question. There's been some information suggesting that a little bit of red wine in particular at night might be useful. What do you think?
Well, it depends on why you're doing it. I mean, some people, you know, some of the researchers have suggested that there's a compound contained within the skin of red grapes called resveratrol, and that consuming this resveratrol will reduce your risk of a wide variety of diseases, particularly cardiovascular disease. But ingesting alcohol, you know, in general is probably not a good thing. It does cross the blood-brain barrier you know, easier than just about any other compound. And so, you know, if you're doing it for the purpose of living longer, you you want to do it by getting more resveratrol. In order to get more resveratrol, you're going to have to drink about 1,000 bottles a day to get enough resveratrol to have any impact at all. So you probably don't want to do it for that reason. You know, if it relaxes you and makes you feel a little bit better, it's probably not going to hurt you. Actually, I'll tell you what I'd really like to hear from some of your listeners, by the way. I'd really love to hear some of them tell me what it is that they see that's good, that's beneficial about growing older.
Okay.
Especially if there's anyone younger out there, I'd really like to hear what some of their views are.
I keep thinking that wisdom is one of those. You got it. Wisdom is somewhat dependent on experience, and that's definitely related to aging. So, but
that's right. But let's see what some of these young people have to say. I'm real curious because, you know, getting my students to think about what's good about growing older is not an easy thing to do when they haven't experienced it.
Would you comment briefly just about hucksterism, bunk, and people either intentionally or unintentionally, because they believe something that's not true, trying to get you to do something that's really unproven?
Oh, goodness. There's a number of books that have come out recently. As I look on my shelf, The Youth Pill, I think, is one. There's a couple of other books that have come out, Merchants of Immortality, that essentially describe the rise, the modern rise of an old industry called anti-aging medicine, where the claim was made thousands of years ago that all we had to do with was ingest some substance or some compound, and this would somehow slow, stop, or reverse our aging. And in fact, the modern rise of chemistry arose out of alchemy. And alchemy was an effort to transform lead into gold. And the only reason why they were pursuing gold was because they thought that ingesting minute quantities of gold would make you live longer. You'd acquire the properties of immortality that gold has. So the amount of hucksterism that has arisen in the modern era is absolutely astounding. It's a multi-billion dollar business. And let me just put it this way. If somebody tells you today that they can stop or reverse your biological aging process, put your hand over your wallet and protect it, because they're going to do everything they can to separate you from your money using something other than scientific evidence to support their view.
Okay. Got another caller. Jonathan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Okay, two things. One, want to now back up to the question about the U.S. falling behind other industrialized wealthy nations. And one was, I want to correct some statistics. Latest census data I've heard, our country is about 12.5% Hispanic, not 15. And although that's rapidly changing, and only about 12% African American, not 25. And the other was, I want to toss out the hypothesis, are we not falling behind, but are we growing less quickly than our other wealthy neighbors, because most wealthy countries, Europe, Japan, et cetera, have much better access to health care than we do?
Yes, I would tend to agree. Some subgroups of the population certainly do not have access to health care and certainly don't have access to education and wealth that the rest of the population has. And I would tend to agree that that's certainly contributing to the longevity differential. There has been a convergence, by the way, of life expectancy at older ages, for example, at age 65, for women in many parts of the world. Currently in the United States, I think it's about 19.5 years. So if you've made it to 65 and you're a female, you have roughly 19.5 years left. That hasn't really changed much in the last 20 to 25 years. Japan caught up very quickly. France caught up very quickly. The Netherlands, one of the longest-lived populations, has experienced a dramatic deceleration in the rise in life expectancy. So there's a lot of convergence going on, particularly at older ages today, among developed nations in terms of life expectancy. So we are pushing up against, I hesitate to use the word limits, but we are pushing up against biological forces that are limiting how long we're capable of living.
Okay. You know, we're getting close to the end, and what I would like you to do is, I don't want to lose the chance to say, what are the best evidence-based things that we can do individually and as a society to help us increase the likelihood of improving our longevity?
I'm gonna rephrase your question.
Okay.
Improving our health and quality of life.
Okay.
And the reason I do that is because how long we live, I would argue, is far less important than how healthy we are along the way. And so I would use healthy life as the goal. And to answer that question, I would say it's fairly straightforward. I would begin with diet and exercise, the things that we can control. We can't control our genetics, but you begin with diet and exercise, and you avoid the things that shorten life. So you avoid the tobacco products, the drugs, excessive alcohol consumption, reduce your intake of calories, try to control stress as much as possible. Excessive stress does have a negative influence on longevity. Once you've done those things, and exercise, by the way, is something that you can do at any age, whether you're 20 or 100, it has a dramatic positive effect on that day. That's probably about the most important thing that you can do. It's sort of like an oil, lube, and a filter for your car. You don't have to do it to make your car run more efficiently, but when you do, it does. And it's the same thing with the human body. You don't have to exercise and you don't have to eat right, but when you do, your body operates like a machine much more efficiently than would otherwise be the case.
What else have we not? We're in our last minute. Is there another issue we have not addressed or something you feel like we should be sure we mention here?
Oh, goodness. To not judge people based on their chronological age. This comes up during my talks all the time, and I would urge people to not judge people regardless of their age based on their chronological age. A 90-year-old can be healthy and vibrant, just like a 20-year-old can be healthy and vibrant, and you can have unhealthy 40-year-olds and unhealthy 80-year-olds. So don't judge people based on their chronological age. Judgments should be based on physical and mental functioning.
I specifically really want to say my gratitude and thanks to you taking the time to be with us today. It's been a very, very good experience. I encourage our listeners to go to our website. There's a number of links to programs and books that you can hear more about this topic. Keep working at it, and I appreciate you taking the time again, Dr. Olshansky.
Thanks for having me on.
Have a good afternoon. Line One is going to repeat next week or be back again next week, as you might guess, and our guest will be National Institutes of Health neuroscience investigator Dr. Doug Fields. So why don't you join us Monday afternoon, January 24th at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line One, Your Health Connection. We'll be exploring the newest information on how our brain functions in health and disease. Pat Yeck is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack helped very generously today by engineering today's program and manning the phones. And thanks especially to those of you who listened and took the time to call and email questions. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.